sessions are really literature and the filmmaker's art more than us doing drama. And so that's basically what we're doing here this week. Robert started life as an accountant, but has been an actor for, goodness, for more than 40 years. Let's put it that way, not to put too fine of a point on things. We met acting, and so that was in New Zealand. So we feel close to this movie, Lord of the Rings, for a number of reasons, one of which is having lived in New Zealand for many, many years, it's all so familiar. So now, I was way back in the distant past. I can't claim great qualifications. I'm not like one of these, you know, college professors. I was a humble English teacher once upon a time, in a previous lifetime, I like to say. And for the past 12 years or so, I've been a pastor. So my interest in this comes from several different directions. My only qualification, though, I can really claim to be doing this is that I am a Tolkien geek. And when they did the little thing in the paper, you know, the little survey, and I got 100% on those 20 questions to show you're a real Tolkien geek. So I know I'm officially one. So anyway, and I hope some of you are too. And we will be using talking both about the book and about the movie. So, how many of you have seen the movie? How many of you have read the book? Books.
Oh, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. Anybody here who has read neither the book nor seen the movie? Okay, one or two.
I'm deprived.
All right. Now, because that was a possibility, I have here a few copies, at least, half a dozen or so, of a short biography of Tolkien. Some of you who have seen it may be interested in this. And also the sort of the cliff note version of Tolkien's life and a cliff note version of the plot of the three novels. So if anybody wants that, so, and some of you who have may want some too. Yes, here you go. Anyone else? I can get more of these. If need be, did you get, okay, so that's got the biography. On the sheet, I hand it out to everybody, and that will be a sheet that we are using. More copies are coming of the, more copies will be coming of the two-page sheet in a minute. So if anyone hasn't got that, let me call your attention to that first. This is just a sort of a brief summary of things you might like to read, further reading, and a very brief introduction to who Tolkien was from the official Tolkien Society site. So that comes right out of the horse's mouth, that little brief summary of who Tolkien was. What I've mentioned at the top, that while the movie trilogy, The Lord of the Rings, is no longer current pop culture, it does remain a resource, a good way to introduce people to Tolkien and what he was all about, and might bring people into reading the book and finding out even more. I should say right up front, because people ask me questions and I say things that are critical of the movie, I do not dislike the movie. There are several things in it I disagree with, but I do not dislike it. I think it was a wonderful work of art in its own right. It did become more of an action film. The book is more a book of ideas. The film tended to become more action, but that's typical of the filmmaker's art, so, you know, can't criticize him too much there. I did argue with having an 18-year-old as Frodo, who was supposed to be 50. That's perhaps one of my biggest criticisms. The other thing is I get critical if I feel something has violated the spirit of the original work. And there's a couple of places where they may come up later where I feel the movie did violate the spirit of Tolkien's book. So those two things I'm a little critical of. But the movie is wonderful in its own right. I've mentioned some things there on the sheet, aspects of Tolkien's life. You see there the years of his life, January 3rd, which is our middle daughter's birthday, 1892 to September 2nd, 1973, the year our youngest daughter was born. Oh yes, I connect with him all over the place. So, some influences perhaps on his imagination. As you know, you can tell there that he was an expert on language, on philology, and on Old English, Anglo-Saxon. That's another connection I have. I've actually studied Anglo-Saxon in college, so he'll connect him. Anyway, some other aspects. He was born in South Africa, and then at his father died when he was a preschooler, and his mother moved the family back to Britain, to England, to be near family. They settled for the years of Tolkien's early and middle childhood in a rural village outside of Birmingham, and it was an idyllic life for a young boy, and later he was to see that village that he remembered so fondly destroyed by industrialization. So those of you who know the movie and the book will understand that was obviously a big influence on him. Also early in life, his mother converted to Catholicism. They were an Anglican, I suppose, Church of England. She converted to Catholicism, and that had a big impact on their life. The family greatly disapproved, and so it made their life difficult. And while his mother died when he was still a young boy of diabetes, Tolkien all of his life blamed the stress and strain of what she experienced because of her conversion to Catholicism for her death. So he remained very emotionally attached to the Catholic Church, a deep emotional connection to it. So it strongly influenced him. Also, the great loss of he was the generation of young men who fought World War I. And he himself was in the trenches for a time, and all of his friends but one or two were killed during the war. So, but as you all know, that a whole generation of English young men and British young men, sorry, Robert.
Yes.
Robert's father was in the trenches also in France. So anyway, a whole generation practically died in that war. So this loss, this great loss of life, and like many young men of Tolkien's generation who survived the war, they had strong pacifist leanings, and we can discuss this in the book. Tolkien obviously is not a pacifist, but there's a strong leaning there and a strong objection to war and what it does. So, then the other question that's important to think about with Tolkien is there was a lot was said when the movies came out. Tolkien had said very strongly that he didn't want people connecting elements of his story with specific things. He objected strongly to allegory, and a lot of people wanted to allegorize his work. Do you know what allegory is? Okay, it's one. This one thing equals that, like in... And mine goes a blank.
Aslan
in C.S. Lewis's work represents Christ. He is the Christ figure in those Narnia books. And that would be an example of allegory. Now, some would dispute whether C.S. Lewis's works are purely allegory or only allegory. And I'm sure we could use the Language in the Wardrobe series also in the way I'm going to hopefully use Tolkien in these sessions. But that is an example of allegory. This one thing equals that. And because Tolkien's books were first published in the early 50s, there was a great inclination to connect totally what he was doing with the war. And so this person equaled Hitler, and the ring equals the atom bomb, and all of that. So people were inclined to do that, and Tolkien spoke out against it very strongly. So people, and this was said when the movie came out, tended to say, oh no, Tolkien said it didn't mean anything, we're not supposed to look for meanings in it. Well, Tolkien himself said, so I had something to say about that, and I've included a bit of the clip here on this, meaning in Tolkien's fiction, that... he distinguishes something being an allegory from something being applicable. and he would claim for all true story, all true art in story, great applicability. So it may be applied to our lives, but not in the narrow allegorical sense. And let's see, I've got the longer part of that quote that's there. He said, what's quoted on the sheet, that I cordially dislike allegory in any of its manifestations and always have done so since I grew old enough and wary enough to detect its presence. I much prefer history, real or feigned, in other words, fake history, with its varied applicability to the thought and experience of the readers. I think many confuse applicability with allegory, but the one resides in the freedom of the reader, that is, to apply a work of art to our life, and the other in the proposed domination of the author. So when it's purely allegory, then the author has imposed a meaning on it and limited its meaning. He also commented in the same place, and this is the prologue to the second edition of Lord of the Rings. He objected then to the tendency to say that the movie was about World War II. The real war, he says, does not resemble the legendary war in its process or in its conclusion. If it had been inspired or directed the development, that is the real war, of the legend, then certainly the ring would have been seized and used against Sauron. He would not have been annihilated but enslaved. The Barad-dûr would not have been destroyed but occupied, sounding familiar. Saruman, failing to get possession of the ring, would, in the confusion and treacheries of the time, have found in Mordor the missing links to his own research into ring lore, and before long he would have made a great ring of his own with which to challenge the self-styled ruler of Middle-earth. In that conflict, both sides would have held hobbits in hatred and contempt, and they would not have survived even as slaves. So that was Tolkien's comment on it. Just to finish this, I've already hinted at this, but the purpose of these sessions will be to think of the Lord of the Rings as not an allegory, but as a parable. And we're all used to applying stories that are parables to our lives, because there are many in the New Testament. So this is something we're used to doing. So in this case, taking the format of the New Testament, it will be: life in the reign of God is like a hobbit setting out on a journey to destroy the ring of power. So we see this journey that is told in this book, and we apply it to what life in the kingdom of God might be about. Each of the nine characters journey in some way through death to life, so it is a journey. And the journey will be tomorrow's session. And it will pick up, start right off with Abraham and Sarah, and if you've been to the Bible studies, and so that will be the topic for tomorrow's session. Today we're looking more at what was God's intention for our lives, so concerning hobbits, taking hobbits as kind of a picture of what God might have intended the good life to be about. At least four of the characters of my view, I say, were in some sense Christ figures, so you could all be thinking about that, those of you who are familiar. Who are the Christ figures in this book, and what ways are they? So instead of just having Aslan the lion as the Christ figure, all of the characters in some way are Christ figures, but four of them especially are Christ figures. Much of what we will say will come from the books as much as the movies. You may not detect some of the stuff we talk about just from seeing the movie alone. There's some suggestions here for further reading. You probably would want it. You don't have to have read The Hobbit before reading The Lord of the Rings. This is not my real Lord of the Rings, incidentally. This is one I just bought recently. My real one is so dog-eared and so falling apart that I didn't want to risk it, a journey with it. So I bought one at a used bookstore. So you might want to read The Hobbit, which gives some background, but it's a book which is a very different spirit, very different feel, tone to Lord of the Rings. The Silmarillion, how many of you have read this? Yeah, okay, a few. So you can see how tattered my copy is. This was once new. But this gives the background mythology, the background to what's going on in the Lord of the Rings is in here. It's kind of like reading Bullfinch's mythology. So you might not want to just sit down and read it all at one go. It's more fun to read bits of it and, you know, put it down and come back and read some more bits. Would those of you who've read it agree? Kind of deep and dense and
yeah,
so.
It's hard to read.
Yeah, very hard to read. This is a wonderful little collection called The Tolkien Reader, which contains Tolkien's essay, which started out as a lecture on fairy stories. And he called his work Fairy Stories, and it explains what he was about, what he felt the applicability of fairy stories were. It also contains a delightful short story by Tolkien called Leaf by Niggle, which I strongly recommend. There are a number of biographies. The authorized biography is the one by Humphrey Carpenter. Some of you may have read that. Any of you read any of the biographies? Yeah, right. And there's also a very scholarly one by Tom Shipley. This is my favorite one, Joseph Pierce, a Catholic scholar, the man, Tolkien, the man in the myth, which talks much more deeply about the significance of Tolkien rather than just an account of his life and what happened in, you know, 1953 or so. And anyway, strongly recommend that. Incidentally, I found as I started reading about Tolkien that the Catholic scholars do see into him very deeply and more automatically. They just really relate. So Catholic scholars, by and large, do comment on him very well. This was also edited by Joseph Pierce, the one who wrote that, and it's called Tolkien, A Celebration, and it contains a lot of essays, literary essays on Tolkien and his significance. I loved this one because it was the first book I picked up that in which somebody, and in this case a Jesuit scholar, said that Tolkien's Lord of the Rings was a parable, and I thought, oh, finally, I'm not out on a limb. I can say it out loud. So up until then, I thought, am I crazy? So anyway, so I recommend those. Now, those of you who have read it, I don't want this to just be a monologue. Those of you who have read it, or seen the movie, or been really involved in it, can any of you want to comment on what it's meant to you, when in your life you found it meaningful, or how you see it?
I first became acquainted with it here at Holden Village. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if it was 1967 or 68. I was here on staff both summers. Mm-hmm. But I remember one afternoon, Andy Hinderly, the youngest of Carol Mary's uh-huh. children, was about 12 at the time, and Martha Lundholm, the daughter of the village musician,
yes.
They cornered me when I was coming off duty in the kitchen, and they said, Edie, have you read The Hobbit? And I said, no. Oh, you've got to. And they took me down to the bookstore to make sure I bought a copy of The Hobbit. And then for the next week, they were asking me about it. And then, of course, the summer after that, they wanted to know what I thought of The Lord of the Rings and
yes.
had some good conversations with them. And that really got
wonderful.
Me started thinking,
yeah,
about,
thinking
it.
About it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the parable idea, is that, how did you relate to it? Or?
I guess I've always assumed that.
I
didn't necessarily say it out loud either, but
yeah.
it just seemed to me to be self-evident that,
yes.
that it was a
yeah.
parable.
That it was a parable, right. And as we go along, I hope you'll all, you know, think about, in what way is it a parable? You know, what connections do you make? Anyone else? Yes.
I would say two main themes every time I read it, and about six or seven or eight times or so. The one is of the, you know, struggling through awful times that, you know, little people can have a huge role. That's
right.
And of course, you can often feel like a little person. And so that's helpful. And then just a general sense at the end of loss, even though it ends well, in a way.
Yes.
There's this world of sadness. I don't know.
Yes.
You know, the first time I finished reading it, I just cried. Even
yeah.
though it wasn't yeah. really that bad, but I realized later on it's just this sense, that's what loss is.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes.
Just to add on to that, one of the great griefs of my life to this day is that I will never be able to meet either a hobbit or an elf. I love both hobbits and elves.
Yes, me too. Yes, right. Oh, sorry, you had something to
I was just going to say, I love the idea of journey.
Uh-huh.
And that we're all on one, and this is just a wonderful unfolding of journey.
I think journey must be the, well, to me, it's the most compelling motif in all of your world literature. And it's all over the place. I mean, how many of you got carried away with, what was that Western thing? Lonesome Dove. Yeah, I mean, the journey aspect of that. It was just so compelling. Yeah, there were, yes.
I think that the aspect that there's help along the journey. Rivendell and Tom Bombadil and
yes.
the places that you sometimes hold it, where there's just kind of this little sanctuary of peace.
Yes, this is kind of a Rivendell, isn't it?
It kind of is.
Yeah,
kind
right.
Of.
Yes.
I first saw Fellowship of the Ring when I was like in second grade,
uh-huh.
and I thought it was, I just loved it, and I thought I loved all the imagination of the whole thing, and of course for a little kid that was really life-changing. So
yes.
So in the 3 years that the movies came out, I was
uh-huh.
just poring over the books and stuff, and I really connected with Frodo and Aragorn and Sam
mm-hmm.
and those guys,
mm-hmm.
And I like the sort of coming of age that they interpreted. It wasn't, I didn't think it was so much in the books, with Frodo coming of age and sort of evolving
mm-hmm.
along the journey, as much as they tried to play in the movies, because obviously he's a lot younger in the movies than he was in the books. So I connected with that more as a kid. And then I also
That's
really loved
point.
the reluctance that Aragorn has to rise to the throne, which again wasn't interpreted in the books quite the same.
No, it wasn't quite, yeah.
But what I did, I mean, obviously that's kind of the way I've become accustomed to them.
Mm-hmm.
But in their own right, I do like comparing and contrasting the books, and I've read the books multiple times, and so
mm-hmm.
yeah, I'm a big fan.
Yeah, great. Anyone else want to comment on what it meant to you, some of our young people? Read it. Well, anyway, I think we all have, and last week this came up a bit in some of our sessions, and I think there's going to be some connections today of the Tai Chi class. I think there's going to be some connections between this gathering of energy and the spreading of energy and this that what comes together is for the sake of being given out. And that was in this morning's Bible study, too, that the gift is for the sake of being given. And so this was a piece that was in the Newsweek. Everybody was waving newspaper articles last week, so I hadn't had mine, too. And this was in the Newsweek. It was a comment on Obama's acceptance speech of the Nobel Peace Prize. And in it, the editor of Newsweek is quoting a previous speech, acceptance speech by William Faulkner, and in it I think he well expresses what the power of literature can be for us, and really summarizes what the power I think of Tolkien's literature is, and Tolkien would have signed this on the bottom too, like yours, you know, that I think he would have found this expressed very much what he believed. I believe, says Faulkner, that man will not merely endure, he will prevail. He is immortal, not because he alone among the creatures has an inexhaustible voice, but because he has a soul, a spirit, capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance. The poet, the writer's duty, is to write about these things. It is his privilege to help humanity endure by lifting their hearts, by reminding them of the courage and the honor and the hope and the pride and compassion and pity and sacrifice which have been the glory of their past. The poet's voice need not merely be the record of humanity. It can become one of the props, the pillars, to help humanity endure and prevail. And I think that would fully summarize Tolkien, so maybe we'll get some quotes from him. Now, are there any other questions or comments before we go on? Anyway, do feel free. And last week I said that I've been longing to do something like this because I keep wanting to talk with people about this, and I by and large haven't found people who wanted to talk with me this way about it. So I'm anxious to hear what you have to say too. And you know, anywhere in the village, anytime, please. The conversation is what I want.
Chance?
Yes.
I have a question. You don't have to respond to it immediately. Yeah. I'm curious, given your history and passion with this work, mm-hmm. quite apart from the film and its excellence, do you have a theory as to why these books have had such a strong place in popular culture in the last few years? Certainly
yeah.
the movie's part of it, but I have a sense it's more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be curious if you have a take on that.
I think it's not just been these last few years. It caught on very strong in the 50s when it was first released. Again, in the 70s, there were new paperback editions, and it caught on very strongly then. There's a comment there that perhaps because of the connection of Tolkien with the environmental movement at that time. So it caught on strongly then. And so, as we just heard, it came to a new generation. And each time it comes to a new generation, I think it does strike that chord. And I think it is because Tolkien was such a deep scholar of mythology, that he has great insight into those motifs in human culture and human history that have spoken strongly to people throughout the ages and throughout, you know, the world. And also such deep insight into the Christian story, too, that I think it's those things that speak so strongly. And people read it and they become connected to it without even knowing why. You know, they have no idea why. But it touches things so deep inside and is so well observed. Yeah. Yes.
And I think he understood how to tell a story because of his
yes.
academic research and his
uh-huh.
understanding of language.
Yeah.
He was able to convey the story
mm-hmm.
of an epic, the journey,
yeah.
in ways that many authors who don't have that academic background
mm-hmm.
wouldn't be able to
do. Wouldn't be able to, yeah. He studied the form so closely and so perfectly. He gets a lot of criticism from the literary establishment, though there are a few exceptions, but a lot in the literary establishment, especially his poetry, they don't like his songs. They think they're silly, or they don't like the poetry. So he has had a lot of criticism, but he's also, from very significant people, had a lot of praise as well. But yeah, he did understand the form so deeply and so forth. Yes.
Being a child in the late 60s, early 70s, I mean, I remember back then when it became very popular, and part
mm-hmm.
of it was the environmental, but also a lot had to do with the peace movements and stuff
uh-huh.
going on.
Yeah.
And then you had, musicians like Led Zeppelin uses it, quotes them in, you know, in some of their songs
mm-hmm.
and stuff, and
yeah.
popular bands, and the Beatles and
right.
other English bands were quoting it.
Yeah.
So that got a lot of the younger people interested.
Yes. Yes, it's always spoken to the younger people, too. Yes?
For me, it's just a matter of this world he has created. Everybody has created a world with languages,
uh-huh.
you know, a whole historical, I mean, it's so brilliant. It's just the past, the thought. I mean, it's so deep
uh-huh.
that every time I open up the book, I feel like I'm in a real
mm-hmm.
different world.
Yeah.
You know?
And were all of you at the thing on Saturday night? About the novel, The Brothers Kay, and we started out
yes.
talking about what makes a good novel, why would you want to read it, and what you've just said was very much a part of that. I certainly feel bereft, and it was the same when I read The Brothers Karamazov. The book ended, and I thought, oh, I can't be with them anymore. So it's why I keep rereading things, of course. But, you know, you do feel that sense of loss that you're no longer there because it is so real. You have entered into this totally different dimension. Well, I think we should. There's three sessions. Today is supposed to be, you know, Tolkien and the good life concerning hobbits, what we can learn about the life that God intends for us from them. Tomorrow it is the journey, and then the third session is on the possibility of homecoming and that strong motif of homecoming, return from exile, whatever you want to call it, in the Bible story, too. And so we'll be doing that on the third day. So, Robert, give us a text.
Ah, this is my only task.
Yeah.
From the book of Genesis. Then the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into him nostrils the breath of life. And the man became a living being. And the Lord God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. Out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, "You may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall die."
Okay, let's have the first clip.
Concerning hops, which living and farming in four farthings of the Shire for many hundreds of years, I contend to ignore and be ignored by the world of the big folk. Middle Earth being, after all, full of strange creatures beyond count, hobbits must seem of little importance. Being neither renowned as great warriors, nor counted among the very wise.
Frodo! Someone at the door!
In fact, it has been remarked by some that hobbits' only real passion is for food. A rather unfair observation, as we have also developed a keen interest in the brewing of ales and the smoking of pipes. But where our hearts truly lie is in peace, quiet, and good tilled earth. For all hobbits share a love of things that grow. And yes, no doubt to others our ways seem quaint. But to they of all days, it is brought home to me it is no bad thing to celebrate. A simple life.
Right. No bad thing to celebrate a simple life. So, given the reading we just heard, and given what you just observed there, how would you describe this hobbit-like life, and what God's intention in creation might have been?
Before the fall?
Yes. Well, I'll say before the fall, yes. Right. Yes.
Sustainable?
Certainly sustainable. Yeah, you saw the care. Yeah, certainly sustainable.
Both work and play.
Yeah, both work and play, yes. Yeah.
Related to the sustainability thing, a sense of enough.
Yes.
Enough.
Yeah, and it's not that they live an austere life, do they? How many meals a day do hobbits eat?
Six.
Six? Yeah, second breakfast, you know, they live a good life. It is a life of, and last week we had a lot of talk about abundance and affluence, and this fit in so perfectly. Their life is one of abundance, but it is not one of affluence. It's one of, what would be another way of talking this morning in the Bible study, perhaps talking about Abraham and Sarah and some of the way the Bible begins. What's it about there? What's that? Describe the community.
Blessed.
Yes, certainly blessed. Yeah, they've been blessed with many gifts. Yeah. Yes?
Unchanging.
There's certainly that, and we're going to have to, because there's a good side and a bad side, and maybe it's not too early to talk about, you know, there's what's the downside of all this? But, more about this, what you see in Hobbit, and how is Hobbit in the picture of what God might have intended in creation?
A harmonious existence.
Harmonious, yes, and if you read, Tolkien's description of what life in Hobbiton was about, they have a police force, but it's kind of ceremonial, you know. They don't really do something. There's no real forces ever applied. It's harmonious. It's communal. Strong sense of community and relationship was the word I was looking for. That it's the relationships that are important in this. And so, any other comments? About it. You can begin to see why it was so important to the environmental movement too. Yes.
I didn't see a time of worship.
No, and Tolkien does not directly, and there's been speculation on that. Maybe some of the others of you have read some stuff about this. Because Tolkien is writing a prehistory, and because I think he wants his work to remain applicable to our story, he never gives a specific religious content to it. But if you read it, God is very much there, but you never see specific worship. Now, the movie has introduced a few little gestures and things that suggest this, and but it's more like that in Tolkien's work that just people living according to what God created them to be is worship in itself. You know, that the rest of the creatures of the world worship God by being, you know, bluebirds, worship God by being bluebirds, you know, and so on. And there's kind of that, but you don't ever see any specific worship in it. And the speculation is that it's because he didn't want to preclude anything. He didn't want to make it non-Christian. So the only way to do that was to not have anything specifically that could be applied one way or the other. Did you have a feeling on it yourself about it?
Well, there's not a sense of a power beyond the human. Mm-hmm. In other words, what was shown is strictly human power. Mm-hmm. And there was not, I did not find a moment in which they had some sense that there was something beyond them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but maybe not explicitly in that scene. Had you read the books?
No.
Okay. In the books, there is certainly written into it and constantly a sense of something beyond. And we'll come to some of those scenes. Beyond what's going on the surface, there is something going, and we may get there today. Yes, sorry, John.
I had to argue a little bit with the previous comment, but also, like the two most significant parts of that scene for me was one when Sam picked the flower, and they talked about the nature and enjoying God's gifts.
Yeah.
And the other part, you know, I'm a little young, smoking pipe weed.
Yeah.
enjoying God's great gifts. Uh-huh. And the reason, I mean, all comments are great, but the reason I think that it's more than just human is because they're taking the world.
Uh-huh.
And just as Robert read from Genesis,
uh-huh.
dust to human, or uh-huh. everyone would be able to quote better than me, but it's just so beautiful.
Yeah.
That it's all the one, and all is and one is all.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that's true.
I would also
yes.
add that, to me, a big part of worship is celebration and
uh-huh.
and the celebrating life, the birthday. That
yeah.
is definitely
uh-huh. yeah.
a worshipful.
The celebration of a simple life, yeah. Celebration, it's Archibald MacLeish again. I like to quote him in J.B. There's a line about giving thanks, and J.B. replies to his wife, who feels they haven't given thanks, that she gives thanks the way a colt gives thanks, by running and frolicking, and that's the way they give thanks, yeah. So, yes, you had something.
See, well, when I read the books, I thought that it was really, and, you know, I read them when I was really young, it was really easy for me to notice a lot of religious stuff in it, too. I thought
yeah.
that all that stuff about the Valar, I thought that was, like, completely supposed to be God, and then
mm-hmm.
the whole thing with Saruman, and Gandalf and how they were kind of descended from that. I thought that was really similar. And that was kind of obvious, I thought, from reading the books.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it obviously isn't explained like that in the movies, just because they can't really delve into the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think that a lot of his religious business is covered
mm-hmm.
just in the mythology. And
yeah.
just because the hobbits don't go to church, it doesn't mean that he's not putting that stuff in.
It's really woven into the
yeah.
the warp of the
world. I kind of like it more
yeah.
too, that
uh-huh.
they don't, you know, go to church and stuff,
uh-huh.
because I think that, you know, that makes it a lot less blatant.
Mm-hmm.
People can have more discussion, and
mm-hmm.
we can have more discussions about it. And plus, too, it, I think it makes it a lot more broad appealing
mm-hmm.
to it, so it's not just centered for the Catholics or anything.
Well, and that's part of Tolkien's wanting it to have wide applicability.
Yeah.
And to be in the freedom of the one who sees it. Well, we can have another scene now and get some contrast going here.
The old world of the islands of industry, forests,
men ready to march within 2 weeks.
But my lord, there are too many.
They cannot all be armed in time. We don't have the men.
Till the dam broke the stream, but the furnace is like dead.
We don't have enough fuel to feed the fire.
The forest of Fangorn lies on our doorstep. Burn it.
Yes.
Okay. Not too hard to contrast. Okay. So, what do you see there? What do you see in that?
You see Hitler built up for war.
Well, anybody's built up for war, yeah. Yes.
But
yeah.
Especially Hitler, with, because of the time and everything, and yeah. Also the breeding of superhumans, super beings.
Yeah, he was actually... Well, breeding or manufacturing these orcs. What would you, those of you who are familiar with it, orcs, what might they represent to you? I don't want to say that they symbolize something, but what kinds of things in the world would you equate the orcs with? You talked about this super thing, but...
I was going to say stormtroopers, the right. Nazi-SS.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah, what would you equate?
I think that they're kind of like people who are always afraid, because a lot of them used to, because the orcs used to be elves.
Yeah.
The orcs used to be men. Mm-hmm. And there's this awesome scene in the movies where Saruman, you see him like making up all these lies to this big group of men,
uh-huh.
And then they get really pissed and they run straight into the caverns, and then
yeah.
You see how they become the Uruk-hai. Uh-huh. So even as a kid, I thought that was really relevant, and you mm-hmm. could see it was because they were kind of driven into fear that they would just rally behind any sort of cause.
We can certainly see the military applications of some of this. Yes,
yeah. In the two different clips, you see two different kinds of stewardship.
Uh-huh, yes.
The one that is more the caring for, the nurturing,
uh-huh.
And living with.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to the utilizing of the resources to their extinction.
Mm-hmm. To their extinction. What word did we use for that?
Consumption.
Yes. Yes, Saruman is pure consumption of it instead of working with it and the growth and the nurturing and all of that that you saw in Hobbiton. Saruman is pure power over pure consumption, using it to its extinction. I kind of liked, and this is getting another aspect besides the military, we can certainly talk about the military with Saruman, but...
It's all right.
You have 15 minutes.
15, oh, thank you. I've often thought of those orcs as all of humanity that is warped and distorted and twisted out of what it is supposed to be by, you know, by society. There's a poem that some of you are probably familiar with, The Man with the Hole, and it talks about this in terms of, we think of agrarian, we look back and think of agrarian society as the golden age. But in this one, in this poem, the poet is looking at that picture of a agricultural worker. And the opening lines are, Wade, oh goodness, now I'm not going to be able to get it. I quoted it last week. Bowed by the weight of century, he leans upon his home and gazes at the ground. The emptiness of ages is in his face, and on his back, the burden of the world. And I kind of feel about the orcs that way, that they are so bowed down, so twisted out of shape. They are, in terms of the story, they're not human. And you saw them being manufactured there from the ooze. They're manufactured. But in terms of the story and the applicability, I see that as all that we have done to twist the humanity out of one another. Oh, this burden we put upon. Yes.
There's maybe the worst of industrialized corporate
mm-hmm.
society there mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. the power, BP, not that the whole thing is, but the result thereof
yeah.
And the drive for mm-hmm. power and acquisition.
And acquisition.
And
yes.
How that works out in a sometimes in a very bad way in large corporate settings.
Yes, true. Yes.
I found it interesting in the books, you don't get it in the movie as much, but the infighting between Sauron's orcs and Saruman's orcs kind of speaks to like bureaucracy and the failure of interagency like cooperation.
Yeah, that competition. Yeah, so yeah, it's really interesting in the book. It's true.
I think of it. I mean, it's kind of like schoolyard bullies, you know, mm-hmm. or like the orcs. They've been shaped by what has twisted them and hurt them in so many ways. And then it's kind of interesting because, in some ways, the ones that have that kind of the power that's come to them in a very twisted way, mm-hmm. maybe become the BP heads and the people that kind of, you know, it sort of creates this world that keeps, anyway.
Clockwork Orange, anybody remember Clockwork Orange?
Yeah.
Yeah, that certainly that kind of thing, yeah.
The Hobbit Society is really egalitarian. In fact, there are no princes. I'm not even sure there are any tradespeople.
There is. Sam is very clearly working class, and Frodo is very clearly a squire. There is class. I mean, Tolkien, I guess I should say, he is a product of his generation, and we cannot judge him by our own standards, but he is he certainly is a product of class society, as well as many women would accuse him of being sexist. But that's another issue. But there is class there. It's reflected there. Yes.
One of the real contrasts that showed up in the clip, as well as in the books many, many times, is the total contrast between the gift of joy and celebration that the hobbits had and the plodding, single-minded...
Yeah.
Evil's probably too strong a word, but that single-mindedness of the orcs who never seems to rejoice about anything except killing.
Yes, yeah. Is someone knocking? Or is that a bird?
It's the bird.
Hello, come in. Yes. I thought I heard. There is that. Yeah, that single-minded in the wrong way. There was a little in the clip of the description on the thing, the idea of gift. That's something to think about too, and that celebration. Receiving life as gift, and that is what the hobbits do. They receive gifts gladly and give them away freely. And what does that tell us about their quality of life? It is one governed by what we would call the big G word.
Generosity,
but grace. It is a life of gift, grace, generosity, use all of those words. That sense that what we have received as a gift is that sense that also allows us to think of, you know, of giving freely also. Because they, and you know, the old saying, it is better to give than to receive. Well, I don't know about you, but I find it an awful lot harder to receive sometimes. And that's because I'm not living in a state of grace. I'm not receiving that grace freely, and therefore I'm a little stingy, you know, and I think we can all relate to that. It's often harder to receive the grace, but it's clear that the Hobbit Society receives it openly and freely, and also give openly and freely. Now, there was some, just think of Saruman himself, the guy with the long white hair, for those of you who haven't seen the movie. What did you see in him?
I thought it was interesting that he was the only one dressed in white.
Yeah.
And you think, is that because evil is sometimes disguised in as good? Uh-huh. Almost like a Christ figure or a, you know, whatever. But I thought that was really interesting. It's been a long time since I've read the book or seen the movie, but that was, you know.
He's
but then when he
good.
Spoke, you knew he was evil.
Yeah.
But just to look at him.
Well, he's been corrupted. He didn't start out evil. He's a Maiar. He is a partly supernatural type. He's not human as such. And Gandalf is the same order of creation as is Saruman. And Saruman was the chief wizard. He was the head of the wizard circle. And he's become corrupted. So that very set apart. What other ways did you see his set apartness and setting himself apart? What other ways did you see that in that clip? thinking of the pictures you saw, the visually.
Even his walk contrasts with Hobbit's movement.
Yes, he's very, he's a, what word would you describe his manner?
Regal,
arrogant, I could say. I mean, really arrogant. I love that picture with from above, and he's on this platform and set apart, you know, and it's sort of very godlike. Mm-hmm. So he's made of himself a god. What is the original sin?
Pride.
Pride. Well, we talk about pride and despair. They both come into this, but humanity wanting to, as I think I said last week, to me, the most untheologically correct popular song ever written was "I Did It My Way." Anyway, that's the original thing, to want to take the power and do it our way, you know. And now we'll show another clip here, and I think it'll help us to get that what we see in Saruman, because I like to look at the actors.
Before I start this clip, I'd like to say that there's no other sessions until 6:15. And given the Nairn's likely or willingness to continue, there's no album to be wanted.
Isn't there? Oh, there's no other session?
So
I think he's going to
be
bored. Enjoy that.
Okay. I like to look at the actor's art. I like to see what they're doing. And we've just seen a wonderful scene with, what's his name, Christopher Lee, as Saruman. And now that scene, and just the faces, and contrasting the faces you saw. What did you see in these faces?
Such humility.
Yeah. Incredibly. And, okay. The book.
The book.
I had a gospel text for today, and it comes from Luke. If I can find it. Last week I used a different one. An argument arose among them as to which one of them was the greatest, but Jesus, aware of their inner thoughts, took a little child and put it by his side and said to them, "Whoever welcomes this child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me, for the least among you shall be the greatest." And yeah, that humility. And then another piece also from Luke, that I am among you as one who serves. You know, I did not come to be served, but I am among you as one who serves. Also think of 1 Corinthians, and not many of you among you are mighty. What is one of the descriptive words of Jesus' disciples that we hear a lot in the New Testament? How are they described as the...
Stupid.
Yeah! We get to folly and all of that stuff. Yes, stupid. Yeah. But the description I like, because I'm 5 foot tall, is little ones. And they are the little ones. And you see that. So you see humility in their faces. What else? Just talk a little bit about the contrast between those faces. So.
Surprise,
yeah. That they are surprised to be treated that way. Yes.
I noticed this time, which I didn't when I watched it as a movie, that all four of the hobbits are really surprised. But then Merry and Pippin on the two ends sort of grin. Oh, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
And Frodo is just so overwhelmed. I think he's still overwhelmed from having gotten rid of the ring that all he can be is shocked rather than rejoicing.
Yeah.
Sam looks scared.
Scared.
Yeah.
And Frodo too. Yeah. I mean, it is as if his face, you know, what's all this and what does it mean? You know, there is that,
incredulous.
Incredulous, yes. But also the, what does this mean? Where is this going?
That the plain and simple amongst us can accomplish the greatest of things.
Yes, yes, and that Tolkien says very, well, he has Gandalf say it very, very directly. That, yeah, it is the little hands that turn the wheels of the world because they must. And little hands, and at one point Elrond says that the weakest among us has as much chance here as the strongest among us. You know, that, yeah. Yes?
There's a real difference in the two, Peregrine and the two that suffered a lot. Suffering, but did not have to carry the weight.
They didn't carry
the
weight of the ring.
So,
yes.
And the difference in the way they handled that situation is very evident.
Yeah, yeah, and they are. There is that delight in, you know. I don't think you could take this too far, but it sort of occurred to me that Mary Tolkien tells us writes the history of the hobbits. He becomes a historian, and Pippin. What kind of a personality is he?
He likes to play tricks,
jokes. Huh? Yeah, he's a bit of a joker, but he's always a little impetuous, isn't he? And doesn't quite think things through. And who does he remind you of in the New Testament?
Peter.
Peter. Yeah. And I don't know. I have no idea. And it's probably a really stretching thing to think of Mary as Matthew and Pippin as Peter. But there's certainly some similarities. But yes, you had something about...
Well, it's kind of like what some other people were saying. But I've always thought that in the movies, they've done really well at showing Frodo as being just a little more mature than all of them. Because all four of them go through a lot of development. Mm-hmm. Through the whole thing, because Pippin has to be the steward of the throne for a little while, and Mary goes off into Pelennor Fields. I don't remember if he did that in the book, but and then Sam, obviously, and this was done just as well in the book and the movie. Mm-hmm. He does the whole thing where he carries the ring for a little while, and then he brings him up Mount Doom, and you know, I say, and he's always a little not trusting Gollum. So I thought that they've all grown a lot in there.
Uh-huh.
But I think that since Frodo is really the only one who's had to really stare into the face of people, he's really the one who's seen the most out of all of them.
Uh-huh.
He's always kind of, you know, there's a lot of moments where, you know, they'll all be together,
mm-hmm.
but he's not really there.
Mm-hmm.
And I that's kind of what I've seen with it. I think that he's
mm-hmm.
definitely the one who grows the most out of all of them.
Yeah, he changes the most, and that's very evident in the story. Well, I see it is 5 o'clock, and that's such a wonderful transition because tomorrow is about that journey and about this journey into vocation, this journey through death to life, and that's exactly what you're talking about there. And, sorry, were you going to say, Jeannie, is there a session in hereafter?
I didn't hear what he said, what John said.
What I meant to say is there are no sessions anywhere until 6:15. There's curry tonight for dinner,
uh-huh.
and it will be available until 6 p.m.,
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, essentially, if you
want to
get a little Tolkien geeky in here.
Yeah. Is he suggesting you show the film?
Yeah, what would you like
what
to...
What are you saying?
Would you like to show some more of the film, or...
I mean, I think
just
people should be here, but...
Yeah.
Or we can set a time to see the whole thing, too.
Yeah, it's 9 hours.
It's nine.
Nine
heavens. That's a
fine.
Could have an all-night session.
Yeah. Well, if anyone does want to stay here and talk... by all means, that'd be great. Yeah.